everyone, and welcome to episode 87 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Well, I will admit to being utterly exhausted after moving the last of my very heavy furniture and mountains of books from one place to another this past weekend, but Peter Konieczny from Medievalist.net really wanted you to still have a podcast episode this week, so he volunteered to come on and tell us about one of his favorite medieval biographies, that of Francesco Dottini, the Merchant of Prato. This is the story of a fairly ordinary 14th century Italian merchant who rises to the top, his unforgettable wife, and one of the richest document finds ever made. So without further ado, here's Peter to tell us all about the Merchant of Prato. All right, well, welcome back, Peter. You are here to tell us all about an Italian merchant who we know about through an unusual way. So let's hit it. Tell us about this guy and why he's important.
All right. So there's this book called The Merchant of Prato. It was published in 1957, became really, really well known during his time, and was like, people like, oh my gosh, this exists. And so the author was like, the author kind of researched her, was named Iris Ortega. And, she was kind of this biographer, has a really interesting life story herself. But she kind of comes across this archive. And I guess it was known among like Italian historians. But in the year 1870, in Prato, they discovered basically under the staircase, all these boxes of letters and notes. And it turns out to be 150,000 letters and 500 like book ledgers, so account books.
Wow, that's crazy.
So like this is the biggest treasure trove like that I think anyone's like ever come across from like one medieval source.
And it was just buried in the stairwell?
Yeah. Basically, Francesco had left in his will like little instructions. Yeah, keep my notes and records safe, right? And we hear about them again like the 16th century, but it seems at that point they were kind of forgotten in this little spot. So then 300 years later, it's like, I think it was literally there, you know, like, oh, what's behind this door? And, oh my gosh. So people have been kind of researching it, and Merchant of Prado comes out. And ever since then, like, that's a book that I think a lot of medievalists or people are interested in like Italian history or, you know, history of economics, things like that, you know, like they have to have that copy. So like I've had this copy, like, you know, bouncing around. I've looked at it here and there, and it's really surprising because so what we have is Francesco, and he was like born in 1335. He, you know, has a kind of like a bit of a rough childhood because like Black Death hits, both his parents die, two of his siblings die. Another family takes care of him. So, but he's kind of on his own, right? He comes apprentice to be a merchant, and in 1358, so in the early 20s, he gets to go to Avignon and work as like basically a merchant there. And this is at a time when the papacy has moved to Avignon. And so there's, you know, quite a lot of traffic, business traffic, especially, you know, from Italy to France. So he's kind of based there, and he starts becoming a merchant of basically a military arms dealer. More like an armor dealer. Like, so he doesn't sell too many weapons, but he is selling a lot of armor. And this is during the Hundred Years' War, so business is good.
Yeah.
And so he's constantly kind of like, so that's his kind of early years, is kind of like importing like all types of armor from Italy, you know, take him across the Alps into France, sells them off to the soldiers and things like that, or customers. And he gets a bit of a following, like, spends about almost another 20 years basically in Avignon, kind of building up a little business, making connections, things like that. He, in 1376, he marries a lady named Margherita Bandini, and she is like, and he, at this time, he's in his 40s. She's about 15. So it's, she's from a family that were like kind of a bit of nobility, but they had kind of fallen on rough political times, which led to her father getting executed.
Oof, that is rough.
So she's got like this kind of family that's kind of, you know, a little proud, but at the same time, you know, a bunch of grifters.
Wow. That's very kind of you.
Hey, that's what she says. So.
Oh, okay.
And so they kind of marry and they move back to Prado. And that's where he's kind of starting his business. And like, so like in the business side, you know, we have all these kind of records dealing with like all his business interests. And they kind of, he kind of expands. So he's a guy that he kind of comes from nothing and becomes basically what we call a millionaire, I would say. By the time of his death, he has 70,000 florins, you know. Wow. So he does well. Like he's basically he's from Prato. He kind of sets up a network of like he hires a bunch of people, so they're staffing places. Like he's got like offices in Florence, Pisa, Genoa, Barcelona, Valencia, Mallorca, Ibiza, Avignon. You know, so he's doing a basically importing exporting kind of business. So you get he's doing English wool from London is coming in. Oranges from Catalonia, copper from Africa goes through the Balearic Islands to him. And he's also selling like works of art. So it's like, you know, like basically some of his clients are like the, you know, bishops in Avignon. So yeah, he's finding like wonderful ways. Like, so you get like lots of things like that. You know, funny thing, the very first mention of ravioli.
is in now, his if that's not worth a podcast, I don't know what is. So the first mention of ravioli, what?
He has in his records. So that's the first time you ever hear the word ravioli is like this food. So yeah, like I gotta imagine like, you know, if people can spend like tons and tons of time going through his like trade networks and stuff like that. But the best parts are really his correspondence with his wife. And that's because like, so there are like, so there's hundreds of letters back and forth between the two of them. And it's because he's spending most of his time outside of Prato. He's like, he's usually like either traveling or he's in Florence, which is like a day's journey away, but he's in Florence or he's like, he's off and doing stuff. So they're kind of corresponding. And sometimes it's, you know, every day, you know, we have records like of, you know, here, you know, what happened yesterday, you know, what's going on tomorrow, things like that. And it alone is this fascinating collection. Because you really like, this is a very interesting couple. So yeah, he's like 20, 25 years her senior, right? And like from his, the early kind of says like, oh, what a, you know, wonderful wife she is, you know, and like, oh, she's meek and stuff like that. But by the time we get to see this correspondence, oh, they have these wonderful conversations, which when I mean that, they are arguing and bickering at each other. And like, she, you know, she doesn't quite like, she doesn't quite like the tone sometimes he has with her. Like, he's always like, oh, do this, do that, you know, any very minute details like, oh, you know, make sure the donkey has enough water to drink and take that water from here, you know, like, and so.
Micromanager.
Indeed. And like, sometimes she doesn't, you know, like, she does not care for these things. So. You know, so like there is like, you know, there's one time where he kind of compliments her the letter and says, oh, you must have had someone write it for you. You didn't write it on your own. She's not, you know, so she surprised, you know, she says, you know, you told me in your two letters and the one you wrote to Piero that I cannot have composed those letters myself, but that Piero de Filippino must have composed them. Excuse me. But he never composes my letters, neither he nor anyone else. You very much underestimate me in thinking I would get to him to compose my letters. If I don't have Simone, I go to Niccolo da Amanto, who seems to be more suitable than Piero da Filippino, or else to Lorenzo. Only of those two would I reveal my secrets and to no one else. Francesco, I acknowledge that I have written to you too freely. And you have demonstrated too much independence from you in telling you the truth. If you were beside me, I would not have spoken so boldly. Slap me in the eyes or in the head, whatever you will. I don't care. I will speak the truth as I know it. I have said nothing to you that I have already said at least once a month. Here, perhaps, I don't speak so directly. And although I do things that make you swell with anger 12 times a day, I may have a bit of Ghiberti tongue. Not that I'm proud of that, but I cannot work out yours. I don't know what need there was for you to write to Piero. you have upset me greatly. And it's not the first time. It seems to me you wanted to clarify this matter. You should have waited for my answer, because according to the women who found me slightly dishonest, a little fond of pleasure, and a bit too friendly for their friars, I have been with you now for 10 years, and I have spoken with them twice a year at most. And from now on, I will have nothing to do with them. I don't collect godmothers and godfathers of every sort like you do. So you are well ahead of me there. I'm not going to give you excuse anymore.
This is not the past in letters, is it?
No. And it's funny, like, and just like a couple paragraphs later, like, she's giving him advice on, like, you know, who to hire. And, you know, oh, and this person's not doing a good job. And, so.
It's just a reminder, everyone should burn their letters or delete their emails before history finds them.
like, I'm just kind of thinking, like, the hundreds of thousands, like, we have, like, 150,000 letters, mostly by Francesco. He is writing all the time. Like, this kind of covers, like, a, you know, 30, 40-year period. So, you know, it's, you know, we're looking at, like, a dozen letters a day, at least. So, and, you know, he's very much a workaholic. And she upbraids him for that too. You know, like, you know, it's like, you know, oh, you know, you send me messages telling me to be happy and to enjoy myself, but you stay awake until morning and dine at midnight and lunch at sunset. I will not be happy, and I'll never be to rest if you don't live differently. So yeah, you got like this kind of, and it's an interesting dynamic. Now, when like there's other little factors, like one thing is they're never able to have children together. And this is something that's kind of can be seen a little under the surface. You know, like at one point, you know, like, you know, she kind of, you know, a little bit melancholic about it. He also has children with other women. So illegitimate, including like slaves that they own. So like there's one case where there's a boy that dies like in childbirth. And he buries this boy in his tomb, so at the foot of his tomb. And then, you know, a few years later, they have him and another one of it, like the slave saves that he has the woman. And she was like, her name was Lucia. They have a child, and her name is Ginevra. And it seems like for the first little while, Margarita does not want anything to do with this girl. She's kind of sent off. But when around the age of 6, it all changes. And she like, we're going to bring Ginevra in, and she literally says, I'm going to treat her like my own daughter. And she's like, you know, like they're basically their child. At this point, the slave has gotten married off to somebody else, has been freed and married off. So, you know, like, interesting, it's a fascinating kind of world, right? Like, you know, where you have, you know, like, servants and slaves, and they're hiring more, like, they're like, this is, you know, he's freeing slaves. You know, after a few years, it seems like it, or in some cases, you know, if he gets into this trouble. But Ginevra is treated like their daughter. And like, there's even like a fun little bit where Francesco sends off one of his men to Florence so he could go buy a tambourine for her.
That's a cute story.
And when she has the wedding, like when they eventually, you know, marry her off, it's like the biggest wedding ever seen in Prato. So, so you have that dynamic. You have, you know, basically, you know, a lot of, you know, there's times when they're very angry with each other.
Obviously.
She seems to, you know, there are times when she's like upset about his extramarital affairs, but at the same time, there's other parts where she seems to have accepted it. And, you know, it's like she wants to be with him, right? Like, that's like, you know, he says, like, you know, one day I'm going to just come to you. You know, you're way off there. You're in Venice. I'm just going to come to Venice, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, that kind of illustrates the fact that people's relationships will change over time. You know, like it's not like your emotions are fixed even from day to day. These letters show, you know. For wives at the time, there's a lot of infidelity, but that doesn't mean that every day is going to be the same in how you feel about it, I think.
Like, you know, at times, like she says, like, you know, the people around town, you know, like they, you know, there's rumors and there's gossip and I hate it, you know, and there's like she had, like, another time she said, like, you know, I can't bring anybody over to our house, you know, because they'll just say stuff. So, because you're not there. But you see a relationship that, between the two, where she gradually, gets more and more authority, I guess. Like, you know, she basically runs the house while he's gone. But as he gets older, like, she kind of takes more and more charge of things.
Yeah. Like, yeah. That's not really unusual for a medieval wife to really be involved, not only in the household, but also in the business, especially when her husband's away.
Like, yeah, she's like, she learns to read and write.
Yeah. So. Either that or she gets someone to write for her, right?
Yeah. Like, you know, like, it was this, you know, like, this correspond, like, you know, at first she's dictating letters, right? And, like, there's, like, there's kind of conversations about that. You know, there's funny, there's one part, like, the one of the notaries says to Francesco, Race of Francesco, you know, I read the letters to your wife, but I always leave out the jokes, the male jokes that we say. So I can't tell her those.
But, oh, great. So that's probably why she learned how to read, so she wouldn't miss the jokes.
Yeah. You know, so, but, like, she, you know, and, like, there's interesting talks about, like, how difficult at times she has, like, reading and writing. Just, you know, it's like she learns through, like, the, you know, religious texts. So, like, she finds the business stuff a lot harder. So,
yeah.
But Margarita, so we have, you know, so, it's like a fascinating, like, dynamic between those two. And, like, you get, it's been actually, well, only fairly recently that, like, the letters of Margarita has been translated to English and published. So there's, I think, about 250 of them. And they're not just to Francesco, but also to her family, to, like, friends and family members. Her family, you know, they come begging for money a lot. So,
yeah.
So at a point she says, like, you know, You're dead to me, you know, to one of them.
So. Yeah, well, I was thinking about how this is a whole lot of parchment to hold on to because, I mean, obviously they're rich beyond belief, but, I mean, they're not reusing their parchments by scraping off, you know, a layer and writing on it again. So this is kind of a real rich person's thing to keep all your parchment and not reuse it.
I think Francesco Dattini is a bit, you know, ahead of the curve, ahead of his times, because, you know, there's a lot of Italian merchants were kind of keeping records and keeping notes, but he certainly just exceeds them all, right? And just, like, keeping track. And he's such a prolific writer. Mm-hmm. Like, people, you know, like, as Margarita complains, like, he is, you know, writing all day, you know, that, and he's such a guy that he can't let things, you know, pass, right? So, you know, It is fascinating. And then you have other kind of letters. Like, you have wonders, like, a friend of his, you know, his name is Lapo Mezzi. And he's like this, he's in Prato. He's just this notary, you know, he's about 15 years younger. And he's like friends. He's like a family friend. And, you know, he kind of is like the good angel on Francesco's shoulder, right? Trying to kind of give him a calmer path, like, you know, like, because he worries that Francesco is just working himself, to death. But also, like, he's, like, missing out on the big picture. Like, he says once, like, you've got a rough soul and frozen heart.
You know? He's like Ebenezer Scrooge.
Yeah. And it's, this is wonderful. He's the one that teaches Margarita to read as well. He calls her his disciple.
Oh. I bet she loves that.
But, you know, it's just like these wonderful kind of conversations that they're having. And, you know, it's, I guess, like, you know, it's not a time, like, we don't live in a time where people write, like, long letters and, like, discuss these things. Like, you know, we just kind of email and everything's quick and dirty, kind of, like, you know, message here, message that. So it's, like, fascinating to see sometimes, like, they sometimes tell tales to each other, like, oh, here's this tale I heard. You know, of the Roman emperor, blah, 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 you know, so.
Yeah, well, we also have phones, right? So if we wanted to tell a story, we wouldn't necessarily have to write it. But in the Middle Ages, you want to tell a story that you heard, you have to write it down and mail it.
So Lapo is, you know, like, he's that one guy, like, he's a friend, but he doesn't want to use his friendship to get ahead. Like, you know, he'll share, like, you know, if there's dinner, he'll come over for dinner, have a nice wine. But like, yeah, don't give me, you know, don't give me money, don't give me stuff. Like, he once tells, you know, Francesco, like, you've sent me all this cheese, I'm going to become a cheesemonger, you know, so stop it, you know.
So Francesco's not all bad. He sounds like he's generous a little bit. And I was skimming a little bit of his bio, not a lot, but did he end up being a philanthropist at the end too? Didn't he will a whole bunch of stuff to charity, basically?
Yeah. Basically, when he dies in 1410, like, he doesn't have any legitimate heirs. He's married off his daughter. And so he decides, you know, like, yeah, I'm going to leave it to the city of Florence, as well as his house. So in the city. And that becomes this kind of, I think, like a basically fund for the poor. And, you know, it's still something that's really recognized. Like, there is, like, you know, a bust of Francesco, like, in Prato. There's this tomb in the city, you know, like, so he's been, like, he is revered, I think, in Prato as, like, this kind of, you know, philanthropist and good guy. But, like, deep down, like, you know, he comes across, his personality is one of this, like, I'm working, I'm doing my thing, I want to make more money, because I want to make more money to make more money, right? Like, one of those personalities, like, and, you know, it doesn't make him happy, right? Like, he says, like, there's one point he says, you know, destiny has ordained that from the day of my birth, I should never know a whole happy day.
Wow. Yeah. That's dark.
Yeah. So he's basically he's worrying about his business. Like, oh, will the ships come in or not? Will they, you know, crash? You know, will the business deal go through? You know, what will happen? Are my workers doing a good job? Yeah. So my wife is nagging me.
Hey, it sounds like he's nagging her even more. Now, at this time, this is a really political time for Italy in terms of city-states and stuff. So was he ever interested in politics, tried to get into politics, or he just kind of stayed out of that?
He stays out of that. Like, he's certainly not one of the, like, he's a rich guy, but he's not, like, super wealthy, right? And he's just trying to kind of, like, he's someone trying to make a business. But he does get caught up in events, like, when the plague comes, you know, him and his family, you know, hightail it to Bologna to, you know, to get out of the wind of that. A year ago or so, I did a piece talking about when a mercenary army, it looks like they're going to come to Prato. And, like, he's like, oh, these, you know, he's like, you know, this army is just going to loot everything. So, like, he sends off, like, instructions to Margherita. All right, we have our villa outside of town. You got to get everything out of that villa, you know, strip it down, like, of, like, every little piece, because they're going to come and destroy it if they get there. And, like, so we have, like, this correspondence between her and him, like, yeah, I've got the guys working, we're tearing it down, we're going to take down the bridge last, you know, there's a couple guys that said they're going to stay there, and, like, they're not going to move. When the other guy, like, one guy's going to stay there until, like, the crossbows, he's in crossbow range, and he's going to flee. So,
aww.
And yeah, they're able to, and, like, he's at the same time, oh, make sure you, like, give out all the money and bread, you know, as you can, you know, like, be generous right now, because, you know, we could need friends, right? So
smart.
And and, like, fortunately, the mercenary army veers off before they get to Prato, and, like, he's like, and he's in Florence, by the way, he says, oh, you know, you did a great job, Margherita, I'm really proud of you. And by the way, send me, like, all the flour you can, because right now there's no flour in Florence. So it's a seller's market.
Yeah, that sounds like a bit of an opportunistic type letter.
It is. Yeah. So it's this. Yeah. You have they're all both fascinating characters. This fascinating kind of family dynamics. You know, there's, you know, even, like, the interesting part, like, they have kind of, they own all these kind of, not a lot of slaves, but they do own slaves. And, you know, there's, you know, one part, you know, where one of them, you know, he gets manumitted, but he still works for Francesco. And, you know, and then he, like, he's working, and Francesco, like, wanted him to take care of a mule, but he didn't do it properly. And he said, like, you know, I upbraided him. And then he says, you know, you know, if I'm treated like this, you know, this guy was complaining, and he took his leave, and he said he would not work with me. He'd rather eat grass than work for me. And he leaves. And so he says, like, he just complains to his wife, you know, like, I freed this numbskull from slavery. This is my gratitude.
It's hard to find good help these days, even when you lift them up from slavery, I suppose.
Yeah. Thanks.
I was going to say, you said that the person who translated and compiled these letters had an interesting life story, too. What was that?
Yeah, Iris Auriga is like an English lady, goes to live in Italy, like in the 1920s. She starts writing biographies. When World War II happens, she joins like the freedom resistance.
Wow.
So she's actually, you know, helping, you know, people escape the Nazis. Hmm. So, you know, and then like, yeah, she kind of has this, you know, history of writing biographies. Right. And like dozens. Right. And this is obviously the Merchant of Prado is like her most famous work. But she was really it seems like quite the person herself. So and, you know, the book, it took off. And ever since then, like there's a lot of people have been doing like research on it because there's so much you could do. Right. I think like the story of Margarita, which Iris tells a bit, like there's like a chapter about like the family, but there's so much more to tell that like we've had a lot of, you know, like research on that in recent years. Mm-hmm. So
histories upon histories. So what's the edition that you're using that you were reading?
Basically, I'm doing the, it's from Penguin Books version, which was from this one, like a 1979 copy. So I got like used bookstore, but like the original is from, you know, 1957. So.
Yeah.
So you can literally, this should be something you could be able to pick up at a used bookstore. Lots of libraries will have it. It's not a, you know, fairly thick book. It's only about, you know, 350 pages. So
is it mostly a biography or is it mostly compiled letters?
Mostly a biography. Like there'll be a little kind of snippet. Iris says, like, you know, I don't put all of Francesco's writings, like I don't put an entire letter because he tends to repeat himself when giving orders. So you'll say, so she didn't like that. So so yeah, there's all sorts of like little snippets and like here's a little bit of daily life. You know, here's things that like they observe just coming and going. Sometimes she gets into like, you know, what it was like in Prato itself. So yeah, so it's like it's one of those books about daily life that, you know, and that is just a pleasure to read.
Those are my favorite kind. Well, I'm awfully glad that you came on to tell us about that. So thank you. That's The Merchant of Prato, right?
That's right.
Awesome. So what's going on the website these days?
Okay. So we have some details on a new online course. It's called A Taste of Christmas Past. It's brought to you by people at Durham University. They've been kind of doing these courses about food. And this is a 3-day course on teaching how to make a medieval Christmas dinner.
Wow. So does that mean goose, you think? Probably, right? Or is that a Dickens thing? I don't know. I'm asking the wrong person, aren't I?
Food, cooking? Like,
that's true.
I hope someone...
They didn't have microwaves back in the day. You'd be lost. What else is going on the website then?
So yeah, you can check out that. You can check out piece on genetics of the Mongol Empire. And we also take a look at the recent like Armenia-Azerbaijani war and how that's like might affect medieval sites in Nagorno-Karabakh. So we've got that. And, you know, just the other podcasts are rolling in as well. So check those out. Byzantium and Friends and Scottish Chronicast. So
that's awesome. All sorts of new stuff every week on medievalist.net. Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being a guest on the show again.
Thanks.
Next week is the 900th anniversary of the White Ship disaster, an event that changed the course of the English monarchy and European history forever. To commemorate the event, I'll be speaking with Charles Spencer over on his Instagram page on November 25th at 6:30 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. You can follow Charles's Instagram account to catch the live stream at cspencer1508. Or you can follow me at 5min medievalist to catch the live stream. Charles's book on the disaster is just called The White Ship, and it's good. I've enjoyed it. So I hope to virtually see you there. The other thing I wanted to tell you about is that I'm gearing up to open registration for the January session of the Medieval Masterclass. So tune in next week for information about how to sign up and how to get a discount on your registration fee. And now it's time to say thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com. Your support is what keeps this podcast going through thick and through thin. So if you love the podcast, why not visit our Patreon page to find everything from subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, or our book club, or our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. If, unlike me, you're actually getting organized around holiday gifts, maybe there's someone on your list who might be interested in some of our goodies. You can find all the action at patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from merchants to maritime disasters, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can follow me, Danielle Sapolsky, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist, and you really do want to follow me on Instagram by next week. You can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an awesome day.